Now, as we did today, we opened up our services with a prayer. And in this prayer, Mr. Burke asked that some people may be healed. How often do you and I pray, hoping for the best, asking for something like healing, but, you know, expecting maybe, maybe not, that this might happen? Is this the kind of scenario, a rule in our prayer? Is it an exception when we ask for God, ask God for something, when we ask for healing in a prayer, and when we're still sick, when we open our eyes, and what goes through our minds? Do we think to ourselves, well, I prayed for this. I know that God has promised it, but I just guess we'll see what happens. Or do we think instead, I am healed? All right, there. I really believe that it is something we all go through. I don't care if it's praying about being healed or praying about finding relief in any other way, or asking for something else you might need. It's something we all go through. We all know, we all believe that God has promised us that He will hear our prayers and give us what we ask for and what we need. And now we all know that those requests have to be made in the right way. But I think it's pretty safe to say that you and I have put this to test and wondered why our requests have failed to materialize. It's a common thing, and I think something we all go through. Now, what I intend to talk about today is not prayers that go unanswered, but rather I want to talk about one thing, and that is the cause of this scenario, and that cause is doubt. Doubt in our heart is the opposite of the faith necessary in our prayers, and it is one of the greatest things that can stand in the way between our relationship with God, between us and God. So today, what I want to do is take a look at the success of faith and the effects of doubt. Now, one most exemplary scripture to kind of set the tone today when meditating on the topic of faith and doubt is in Matthew 21 and verse 21 and 22. I'll have you turn there. And I wanted to open up with this scripture because it is familiar, and it really gives us an example of just how powerful faith can be. Matthew 21, starting in verse 21. This is after Jesus had just caused a fig tree to wither. So Jesus answered and said to them, "Assuredly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt," those two simple things, "you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, 'Be removed and be cast into the sea,' it will be done. And whatever things you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive." What a promise, right? This is amazing. All we have to do is ask and believe and don't doubt, and you can move mountains. Now, the irony here is that even this is hard to believe, right? It's one thing to believe that you can move a mountain, but it's another thing to believe that just asking for it, you can move a mountain. So it's a tremendous thing to overcome. Opposing doubt is faith. In order to overcome this, we need to really work on our faith. It is a tremendously powerful force within us, that promises to provide us with the capacity to do things that defy logic and reason. So what I want to do today is just go through one story that you may or may not be familiar with. I'm sure you are. This story is about King Asa, and I'm going to spend most of my time here today. And this is in 2 Corinthians. If you want, you can turn over there. The story starts in chapter 14. So 2 Chronicles, chapter 14, and I'll be skipping around a little bit so you may find it easier to listen as I move around, but I will cite scripture as we move through it. Now, the story about Asa I chose because it contains a really good example of faith, success because of faith, and weakness and doubt, and the ultimate failure that happens from that. Now, of the kings of Judah listed in the Bible, Asa was a pretty good one. It does say that he was a good king. He removed altars to foreign gods and commanded his people to seek God and observe the law and commandments. And in the example that I'm going to go into right away, in a situation where he was threatened, he proved his faith. So if you're in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, I'll begin reading it in verse 8. And Asa had an army of 300,000 from Judah who carried shields and spears, and from Benjamin 280,000 men who carried shields and drew bows. All these were mighty men of valor. Then Zerah the Ethiopian came out against them with an army of 1,000,000 men and 300 chariots, and he came to Maresha. So Asa went out against him, and they set the troops in battle array in the valley of Zephath at Maresha. And Asa cried out to the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing for you to help, whether with many or with those who have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on you, and in your name we go against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Do not let man prevail against you. And so, what happens? Verse 12, so the Lord struck the Ethiopians before Asa and Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. I don't know if you were doing the math there, but Asa's army was outnumbered by about 2-1, and I don't think that these were small guys. He had cause to be frightened, but he was faithful. And because he was faithful and genuine in his request, God helped Asa and protected his people. Asa's motivation here is important. It was correct, right? He was trying to give God glory and not man. That was his intention. And according to God's will, Asa was successful. He really was faithful here and met success because of that faith. Tremendous success. I mean, that is, can you imagine 1,000,000 people coming after you, threatening you? So after this victory, everybody's excited and thrilled. I'll continue on in 2 Chronicles chapter 15 and read verses 1 and 2. Now the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded, and he went out to meet Asa and said to him, Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. The Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you, but if you forsake him, he will forsake you. I see this as a little bit of foreshadowing. As we'll get down into the story, you'll see what happens. Now, we don't know exactly what was going on in Asa's heart at this point. We don't know if he was puffed up with pride because of this victory. But Asa responds by hearing this, and he takes it to heart. And continuing on in verse 8 through 10, following the prophecy of Azariah, and when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Oded the prophet, he took courage and removed the abominable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities which he had taken in the mountains of Ephraim. And he restored the altar of the Lord that was before the vestibule of the Lord. Then he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and those who dwelt with them from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon, for they came over to him in great numbers from Israel when they saw that the Lord his God was with him. So they gathered together at Jerusalem in the third month in the 15th year of the reign of Asa. So the reason why I wanted to bring this up is that Asa is being obedient. He responds by being obedient, trusting in God's ways, even against adversities. What if you think about what he is doing? He is taking down altars. He is actively doing something that is right, but may cause some conflict with the people of the land in which he is ruler. By his faith and by the way he acts through that faith, God blesses him, and his reward was peace. Looking in verse 19, we can read, "And there was no war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa." Again, doing a little bit of math, for 20 years following the victory over Ethiopia, there was no war. What a tremendous gift, right? Because of that faith, a true success. Now, 20 years is a long time, and most people change with time, as is the case with Asa. His attitude changed. We don't know exactly how, but perhaps he'd become comfortable as the king. Complacent might be another word, being in control. And he became weak. Let's take a look and see what happens. Reading chapter 16, starting in verse 1. "In the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha of Israel came up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might let none go in. Let none go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa brought silver and gold from the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, 'Let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. See, I have sent you silver and gold. Come break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me.'" He's scared again, right? But how does he respond to his fear? Not with faith, not the right way. He responds by trying to strike a deal within the way that he feels he can control. And really, if you think about it, it's not just doing that. It's taking valuables out of the treasury of the temple. Okay, continuing on. "So Ben-Hadad heeded King Asa and sent the captains of his armies against the cities of Israel. They attacked Ijon, Dan, Abel, Maim, and the storage cities of Naphtali. Now it happened, when Baasha heard it, that he stopped building Ramah and ceased his work." So it worked, right? "Then King Asa took all Judah, and there he carried away stones and timber of Ramah, which Baasha had used for building, and with them he built Geba and Mizpah." So Asa might be thinking, my plan worked. Is that what he's thinking? Probably. Right? However, "And at that time, Hanani, the seer, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, 'Because you have relied on the king of Syria and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand. Were the Ethiopians and the Lubim not a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. In this you have done foolishly. Therefore, from now on, you shall have wars.' Then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in prison, for he was enraged at him because of this. And Asa oppressed some of the people at that time." So he's really going against the faithful ways that are truly successful. It's sad. Continuing here, just seeing how the story ends. Note that the acts of Asa, first and last, are indeed written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. "And in the 39th year of his reign, Asa became diseased in his feet, and his malady was severe." And how does he respond? "Yet in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, where he would find healing, but he sought the physicians." Doubt crept in. He had proven his faith before, but he allowed doubt to take place instead of faith. And in doing this, Asa put his faith in the things that he thought that he could control himself. Being a king, you get a feel for power, and you can control certain things. And he put faith in those things. And because of this, by putting faith in worldly things, in his own might, in not putting faith in God, he closed God out of his life. For Asa, the range of possibilities was no longer within God's scope, which is tremendous and limitless, but rather within the range of things that only he could control. And that same thing holds true for us. If we remove our faith in God and what He can do for us, if we begin to doubt and trust in only the things that we can do and the things that we can control, we're limiting the range of possibilities. When we forsake God, God forsakes us. When we doubt that He will help us, He's not going to try and help us. He wants us to be faithful, and He requires it. Now, what I wanted us all to take away from this story is that the limits that we face in our lives are directly related to the breadth and the depth of our faith in God. The greater that our faith is, the greater the range of success, because we tap into that ability of God to help us. Okay, so we know that faith is important to have, but that's one thing to go home and think to yourself, oh, all I need to do is be faithful, right? And that's hard. It's hard for that thought to really be effective. It's still an abstract idea. We have the question, how can we be faithful? How can we overcome doubt? And for that, I'll read one last scripture, and this is in James 2, verses 20 and 20 through 26. James 2, but do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? And this is the scripture I want you to really pay attention to. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. Faith is not sufficient, nor are works sufficient for us to be successful. Just as spirit gives life to the body, so action gives faith, gives life to our faith. Faith is proven by our consistent action, and it is the only way to overcome doubt. We need to act consistently with our faith and believe. It's the only way we can prove it. Only when our faith is alive and in action, only then will our limits be within the bounds of God's control. Otherwise, they are doomed to be within our own.